for Poetic Justice. This is Dan Raphael. While we're recovering from the elections and fretting our democracy,
you're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Mike Moen, Shantaya Hudson, Eric Galatas, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, about his latest story. It's called Multnomah County DA Releases Corrections Grand Jury Report. A 7-member grand jury spent 5 weeks inspecting 4 Multnomah County jails, revealing challenges of maintaining the local carceral system. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. This new piece of yours covers the grand jury report on the state of Multnomah County jails. Before we get into the content of the report and what the grand jury found, how did they go about analyzing the county's jails?
Yeah, like you said up front, a seven-member jury, grand jury, spent 5 weeks inspecting these jails. They did interviews with a wide variety of people who interact with and are a part of the criminal justice system, doing interviews, with people hearing testimony from staff. That's like the sheriff, the district attorney, corrections healthcare directors, public defenders, financial managers, and others. It's a pretty comprehensive list of people that they heard testimony from.
And they do this every year?
Right, yeah. They're required by state law to do it every year.
So this report that they've put out has some pretty grim warnings about the state of affairs in Multnomah County jails and what is likely to happen if the county doesn't take action. One big issue is short staffing. What does that look like in the county's jails?
It comes from a lot of different angles, and I always want to caution listeners that when any police department is talking about staffing, there is a very good chance that they're trying to get more money. So there are certainly a lot of shortages. This report said the Multnomah County jail system is in crisis and at risk of jeopardizing public health and safety. The staff to prisoner ratio within the jails in Multnomah County is not good. That is obviously a question of, do they need more staff or do they need to be putting fewer people in prison, which isn't exactly something that this report suggests, but is something for the community to consider. But the staffing really is a top line item because it affects, healthcare. It affects, prisoners, how often they're left out of cells. And just the kind of general care that people get while they're stuck in those conditions.
The report also brings up short staffing of court-appointed lawyers, which is a statewide issue that's been going on for several years. How does that fit into this?
Right, it's a major problem, and outlined in this report is saying it, you know, criminal defendants in custody without representation are at risk of having their constitutional rights violated. There are some 3,500 people who are on pretrial release right now, but who do not have public defenders to go through their cases. And then another, the Oregon Capital Chronicle recently reported that there's another 160 people in Oregon who are in jail waiting for public defenders, people who just cannot afford an attorney of their own. That is a massive challenge. The state is roughly 1,300 public defenders short of what it needs. And it's a real crisis. It really is impacting people, and it is a constitutional, it's a violation of their constitutional rights.
I want to quote from your article here, quote, "With the compounding public defender crisis leading to longer, sometimes unconstitutional holding times, the report said MCDC, that's the Multnomah County Detention Center, has reduced booking hours, extended lockdowns, requiring prisoners to spend further time in isolation, limited professional and social visiting hours, and delayed access to medical care," end quote. So it really impacts so many different things and how people are forced to spend their time.
Right, absolutely. And this report also notes that there's an expected increase in that population, in the population within jails. And so while this is already a crisis, and they are in crisis mode, there's sort of an expected balloon to happen here coming up. So the idea that, you know, this obviously leads to, and maybe we'll talk about recriminalization of drugs and the number of people who are being booked into these into jails on low-level offenses could just really exacerbate the problem.
Right. Well, I did want to ask about that. As, you know, this jury report is finding that staff is being stretched really thin past minimum staffing levels of, like, what is safe for the amount of people who are being kept at the jail and the amount of people that work there. The report also found that their workload and the demands of their job are increasing. You mentioned a little bit, but let's talk about it specifically. Why are there more people in jail right now, and why are the demands of people who work there, why are the demands on them increasing?
Yeah, there's an anticipated increase in pretrial detentions in 2025. It's a result of this presiding judge order that tightens restrictions on pretrial release for certain offenses. So that's already expected to be one problem. Of course, penalties for possession of a controlled substance went into effect September 1st. And so the criminal justice system, you know, while people may not, are maybe available or eligible for deflection programs, it still is wrapping a lot of people up in a system of criminalizing drugs. Nathan Vasquez, the incoming district attorney, ran on a platform of, you know, promising to prosecute low-level crimes when he takes office in January. And I think we're just kind of seeing the effects of having police and jails who have most of the funding, you know, being the answer for every issue.
Like you mentioned, one of the places that people are sent to if they're caught possessing drugs is the county jail if they're not eligible for deflection. What does the early data show about how that system is working in Multnomah County so far? I mean, since September when this started taking effect.
Right. I think this is really interesting because I think that if you asked, you know, many people in the community how many people, now that drugs are illegal again, are being booked into jails, they would probably tell you it's in the tens of thousands, which is a little hyperbolic. But I did reach out to, you know, the sheriff's office. John Plock, their public information officer, told me that they've booked 48 people into Multnomah County Jail for drug possession charges alone after they refused deflection services. They're usually there, he said, an average of like 11 hours, so kind of a short stay. He also told me that 254 people have been booked for drug possession in addition to other charges. So of course, you know, depending on their ability to pay for an attorney, those are people who may be in jail on multiple charges, you know, for an extended period of time. At least 133 of those people are people that Portland Police Bureau took to jail for possession of a controlled substance.
I was also interested to read about what the Portland Police Bureau was describing as some of the reasons that folks ended up in jail as opposed to deflections. Can you talk to that point a little bit?
I can. I got a bit of a cynical response from Mike Benner, the PPB's public information officer. He said, please keep in mind of those 133 people they've taken to jail, that those individuals could have gone to jail for a variety of reasons. He said they chose to go to jail. They had additional charges, a warrant or detainer. They were a danger to themselves or others. They weren't eligible for deflection, or the county said they couldn't arrive in 30 minutes, or mobile deflection took over 30 minutes. That's because PPB policy allows officers to wait 30 minutes and then take someone to jail if they can't get someone else to take them, a support specialist. I asked him to clarify what he means by they chose to go to jail, and he told me that it's just what it sounds like, sort of declining to offer any other options for someone who is in that situation.
The 30-minute limit is part of what stuck out to me.
Right. It is a really interesting thing. I mean, of course, they're, PPB wants to be able to move on to the next thing soon, and maybe... you know, maybe their ideas are changing. Some recent reporting has shown that they're a little more acceptant of, you know, accepting of this new deflection thing. But yeah, I mean, officers, you know, just by policy, only have to wait for 30 minutes.
Well, to get back to this report, right, another thing the grand jury pointed out is the deterioration of the buildings, the jail buildings in Multnomah County themselves. What did they see specifically?
Yeah, they noted that, you know, a lowball figure, you know, not earthquake-proofing any of these buildings, it would be $100 million to repair the buildings, and up to $250 million if they were to take those measures. And I guess so I should say, too, that the county has been considering for a while just making a new jail, building a whole new jail because of so many of the issues here. This grand jury reported that they were concerned about outdated electrical systems, poorly functioning water and wastewater systems, water damage, poor lighting, broken elevators, and outdated HVAC systems. They ice storm last January kind of highlighted that urgency, and people inside went without heat for 4 days. Something that that this grand jury felt could be a recurring issue if they don't address those repairs. So it is really expensive on the one hand, but again, another reason that jailing people is one of the most expensive ways to solve social problems.
The report also pointed out hundreds, I think, of open maintenance tickets just having to do with the Multnomah County Detention Center downtown.
Right. There are hundreds of, yeah, I confirmed this with the county. Julie Sullivan Springetti, the communications director, told me, you know, that they prioritize these kind of based on if it's 24/7, if, you know, if people are in there 24/7 versus other areas where it's, you know, just office hours and stuff, trying to address all of these things. But there is a big backlog and seems to be something that, maybe is a staffing issue too. There's a lot of talk about staffing in this grand jury report, but sort of regardless of who is at fault here, because there's a bit of finger pointing back and forth between the county and the county's jails. People in there are impacted by this stuff every single day, and they have no other option of a place to go.
Well, there was also a big shakeup in leadership and sort of the healthcare system at Multnomah County Corrections earlier this year. I wanted to ask you about that as well. How are things faring now?
Yeah, Sreer was reported on this it was 2022 and 2023 when, you know, seven people died in Multnomah County jails in 2023, three people in 2022, which is a lot more than in the years prior. So there was a lot of issues. The county and the sheriff's office kind of said that this is due to a rise in fentanyl. Street Roots got the medical examiner reports and found that actually drugs had very little to do with most of the deaths in jail. And, you know, they said that they had staffing issues then too, but the Mike Obiero, the Multnomah County Health Director, Corrections Health Director, resigned after a vote of no confidence from the Oregon Nurses Association, in which more than 90% of corrections health nurses said that they had no confidence in him. This year, there have been far fewer deaths. There's been one this year. So there's a potentially a correlation there. Not something that we know for sure.
And what did the grand jury have to say about the juvenile detention facility?
This strikes me too. They heard testimony from people there saying that kids in jails benefited from trauma-informed spaces, and said that a lot of the people there have experienced human trafficking. I do find some cynicism in the idea of trauma-informed spaces in jails, jail itself not being particularly trauma-informed, but it's something that they recommended. As some of the programs, like some of these kind of specialized services that they offer for people, gave some reprieve to the young people that are staying there. They still thought that a tablet program is not apparently something that exists in the juvenile detention center, and they thought that that would be good for kids who wanted to learn, have different educational programs and stuff.
What typically happens after this grand jury report is released? Is the county commission going to take action on these things?
That's certainly to be determined. I mean, these are released every year, and many of these issues that the grand jury reports highlight are the same issues. And the report this year mentions, as mentioned previously, quite a few times. So one of the things about jail is that it hides people. And so a lot of these issues will come to light when the report comes out, and then people will generally go about life outside and sort of forget about it. So it's hard to tell what's going to happen next, but there is at least a record of it and what the county decides to do or fails to do in the future.
What are the main takeaways that you hope folks get from this story?
Jail is not a particularly beautiful place. It's very expensive, and a lot of these challenges are things that could potentially be addressed outside of the carceral system. That's something that is just outlined over and over again in this report. There are a number of things that that could help with a lot of these issues. We'll see if it happens.
If listeners are interested in finding out more, reading your reporting for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
It's a great time to support Street Roots vendors. They're outside of your neighborhoods, or outside grocery stores, and they accept cash, Venmo, and tips. You can buy a printed newspaper from them or find us at streetroots.org.
Well, Jeremiah, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks, Althea. Nice talking to you.
That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest story. It's called Multnomah County DA Releases Corrections Grand Jury Report. A 7-member grand jury spent 5 weeks inspecting 4 Multnomah County jails, revealing challenges of maintaining the local carceral system. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. Tax havens are places with very low tax rates that enable multinational corporations and individuals to get around the law. These global havens have been responsible for depriving governments of billions of dollars in tax revenues. James Henry is an investigative economist and global justice fellow at Yale University. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg, who began by asking him about the most recent investigation he's been involved in.
The latest investigation we've been doing is of a couple big Swiss banks. The top 2 banks in the country have merged. And
it doesn't have anything to do with the scandal that Credit Suisse had a few years ago?
Oh, yes. Well, we were deeply involved in that. Ralph Nader and I went to the Department of Labor in 2015. Credit Suisse had pled guilty to a corporate felony involving helping wealthy Americans take money out of the country. And under the provisions of the law, if you are advising U.S. pension funds, you have to declare any kind of conviction that you've had under U.S. law, and you're supposed to be ejected from the program for 10 years. But the Department of Labor has historically always given waivers to these big financial institutions that get convicted. And the two banks in question, UBS and Credit Suisse, the largest Swiss banks that are now merging, have accounted for about 14 of the 37 waivers that have been given historically by the Department of Labor. They have a virtually unblemished track record of giving waivers.
So is the Department of Labor one of those revolving door departments where people from the industry actually serve in the department? It doesn't seem like that department would be that way, but isn't it?
Yeah, I've been surprised. I mean, this was the Obama administration back then. We had a whole day-long hearing on Credit Suisse and talked about their criminal history, including their failure to, their reneging on their agreement with Holocaust victims. We had several survivors come in and testify about Credit Suisse never paying them under the 1990 agreement that was supposed to compensate the Holocaust victims for the amount of money that Swiss banks stole. But, you know, though they went on and gave them a waiver that year, and as we warned, institutions that have a track record of sort of serial criminality are really not likely to survive. And indeed, just last year, Credit Suisse hit the wall. They nearly failed, and the Swiss authorities decided to merge them into the other big bank, which is almost easily equally
almost
criminal.
As bad.
And so right now, this very moment, we have a request for another public hearing. We've submitted a long comment letter. My international coalition, not only Nader, but also experts in Australia and Germany and South Africa and Kenya, who've seen Credit Suisse at work and UBS at work for decades, basically ripping off developing countries and making a business out of taking the capital flight back home. We've seen this time and again. Now they're before the Department of Labor again with another request for a waiver. So this is this is like an ongoing soap opera, but it's an opportunity, one of the few you get in the U.S. Power system, to actually have public hearings about the behavior of these big financial institutions. So we will at least have this story will be told.
So if big corporations or wealthy individuals try to evade taxes by taking their money to, I don't know, Luxembourg or Bermuda or the Cayman Islands or one of those places, do the U.S. authorities go after them in a bigger way than with...
Well, they're supposed to, but basically the trend has been toward, you know, I would say a lack of enforcement. The IRS has cut its staff by about a third since 2012. There was a bill that Biden had passed to increase the resources so that the IRS could actually do more enforcement, including global enforcement. But generally speaking, you know, that's run into the Republican wall. And so they're really starved for resources. Secondly, a lot of this money is hard to trace. It's once it gets offshore, there's a lot of financial secrecy. And indeed, U.S. institutions have also become very secretive. I mean, one of the biggest recipients of dirty money is the United States, because we have financial secrecy just about as good as anything you can find in the Cayman Islands or the Isle of Jersey.
So the notion that tax havens are all offshore is really false.
Oh, yeah. No, the tax havens of choice in many cases are ultimately, I mean, you have to go through, you know, layers. There's about 141 jurisdictions that we consider to be financial secrecy jurisdictions in the world. When I started studying this topic back in the 1970s, there were 15. So this has exploded. Little companies, countries like, you know, the Isle of Man and Mauritius getting into the business. But those are sort of the intermediate sort of stepping stones, the place that people really want to ultimately invest their money. The crooks of the world, the kleptocrats, the tax dodgers, it's a little bit like the Star Wars bar scene. You know, if you remember the Star Wars movie, all the crooks are sitting around the same basic facilities, making use of the same kinds of lawyers, the same lax regulation, the same low taxes. And ultimately, they want to get their money into a place with laws. So that's the irony. They want their investments protected. So they want to be in the United States. They want to be in Switzerland. They want to be in the UK. These are places that are, if you look at Transparency International's annual list of comparative corruption, you know, places like Switzerland, the United States, and the UK are always way, you know, we are way down the list in terms of corrupt places. You look at the African countries, they are the corruption. There's this notion of corruption being an indigenous characteristic. What we pointed out is that it's actually just the opposite. The enablers of this kind of kleptocratic system that we have are all first world countries. They're the ones with the banks and the law firms and the accounting firms that really make a business out of ripping off developing countries.
Do you have any idea, just looking at the U.S., how much revenue is lost because of these tax havens?
Well, if you divide it into a couple different categories, one is corporate tax dodging, and that has proliferated since the 1970s. A lot of companies like Apple, you know, had set up a company in Ireland to receive something like 60% of their global profits, basically as a citizen of nowhere for tax purposes. So it was a clever instrument that allowed them to park all this money offshore tax-free for decades. It didn't bring the money back. They wouldn't pay taxes. So corporate tax dodging, we figure, is on the order of $200 to $300 billion a year of lost revenue just from big companies that are doing that kind of thing. On the individual side, the numbers are at least that high. We're figuring something like $50 to $60 trillion of offshore private wealth that is essentially not taxed. That would include the money that's owned, you know, let's say in the United States by wealthy Russians who are not paying taxes here. So it's basically become a situation where more and more of the tax burden in the economy for unavoidable expenses like health and welfare and roads and policing and stuff like that are being borne by ordinary people, by the working class. We now have a regressive tax system in the world as a whole. And that's something that's a big reversal from when I first started working on this in the 70s. We had a progressive tax system, but that is pretty much out the window now.
So periodically, laws are passed by Congress to stop this kind of practice and to rein in these people. So what's going on there?
Well, you have 2,500 tax lobbyists in Washington, and they're not working for me and you. And so you have an IRS code, which has now got 75,000 pages of regulations. It's basically a full employment program for lawyers. You know, they've talked about a wealth tax as a possibility. I mean, I think that's a nice idea, kind of an armchair economics idea. In practice, it's very hard to tax wealth when you have, you know, billionaires who have free range on the planet and they can kind of move their money easily from one place to another. So if you slapped a wealth tax on someone with, let's say, you know, there are all kinds of valuation problems. How do you value a fellow's art collection? And, you know, and the unrealized portion of wealth is probably most of the wealth that's out there. It's like a full employment program for lawyers to set up a wealth tax.
So if the plan put forth years ago by Steve Forbes or brought back in another form, maybe I think Jerry Brown said it, we need a flat tax. And the idea I got there was that they were going to eliminate all the tax laws and just have this one flat tax. And of course, it would be regressive, but the idea was to just simplify the system and make sure that people really did pay their taxes. What do you think?
Well, I think it's possible to do a much simpler kind of income tax. We have all the structures in place to do a reasonable income tax. But there are other kinds of taxes that I think are relatively simple to implement. For example, New York State, since 1905, surprisingly enough, a Republican governor back in 1905 was facing a budget deficit. And against the opposition of everyone on Wall Street, he enacted a 0.1% transactions tax on stock trades. And everyone predicted that all of the stock exchanges would move to New Jersey. Actually, nobody moved. The tax was very successful. It operated well for 75 years. And then finally, Governor Kerry, who was in the pocket of Wall Street, repealed it. He actually didn't repeal it. He rebated it. So since 1982, New York State, which is a host to the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ exchange, the two biggest exchanges in the world, has rebated to Wall Street, these, you know, sort of deserving poor on Wall Street, something like $500 billion that could have been saved by this tax. So we have a proposal now before the legislature, given the dire straits that New York City is in, to simply stop this rebate, to repeal this rebate of the 1905 tax. Well, of course, that would then clear the way for European exchanges and Asian exchanges to have similar kinds of financial transactions tax. And the whole thing could be a very good way of funding, say, climate change solutions. If we had a global financial transactions tax, that could easily raise $200, $300 billion a year without dropping a beat. I mean, it's a tiny tax per share of all the stock trade. There's something like $173 trillion of stock trades on the world's 85 stock exchanges now. So the idea of moving toward financial, you know, progressive sales taxes of various kinds is one alternative to the wealth tax. But I don't think there's any magic bullet here. It's a question of getting Congress to actually understand that we need better tax enforcement of existing tax laws. And there's some big obvious loopholes that can be fixed. And we can try some of these more innovative transactions-oriented taxes.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at